Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Dr. Jessica Ryder. She's the director of the Be In Fit program at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore. She's been working with adolescent girls struggling with obesity for many years. I'm really excited to have her on talking to us about her work. Of course, before I do that, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city. I want to share with you a recipe, and I want to share with you some things that I've just recently done that I think are really great, and you might want to take part. First, last night, I went and saw the controversial documentary called Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe. And it's a film about vaccinations, obviously, and it's mostly focuses on the MMR and that that vaccination that put together three previously separate vaccinations into one vaccination, and the stories of how many people, children, experienced autism following that vaccination. And it is really scary. Of course, you know, they talk about a cover up, and it was pulled from the Tribeca Film Festival, so you might have read about that in the New York Times. You know, Robert De Niro thought it would be a good idea to have it in, and then for some reason it was pulled, thinking it was too controversial. But it's really hard to sit and watch that movie and not believe that it's true, that this happened. It's just, you know, it's just too uncanny that there's so many parents describing the same reactions following the vaccination. And, you know, in general, I have to say, you know, for the most part, I'm not always very trusting of, you know, what comes out of the medical establishment, because I think they are so tied up with big pharma. And everyone's looking for profits, and it's big business, you know, when people are sick. That's one of the reasons it's so exciting to have Dr. Jessica Ryder joining us today, because she's really working towards getting to not just dealing with the symptoms and treatment, but really trying to get to the root of some of the problems. And I think we need to really look at things more holistically, the whole picture, and work towards getting people healthy from the beginning, from the start, you know, and that very often starts with, you know, healthy nutrition at home. And if they don't have it at home, that's one of the reasons we really need to up the ante with school food and gardens in schools and teaching kids about healthy nutrition when they're really young so they can go home and influence their parents. I remember, you know, when the no smoking campaign was really strong when I was in elementary school, and coming home and talking to my mom, not wanting her to die, and, you know, crying and all that stuff. And eventually she quit smoking. You know, kids really can influence their parents. And so I really recommend everybody seeing this movie, Vaxxed. It's really great, even if that's not your particular issue, just to open your eyes up to the kind of coercion and deception that does take place within not just the medical profession, but, you know, the biotech companies and the pharmaceutical companies and the food agricultural companies. I mean, we just don't get the full picture so often, and it's so important. And with the use of the internet, we have access to good information, and we really need to follow the trail, follow the money, and be investigative consumers on our own so that we can really get to the truth of things. So, you know, I also yesterday went to a rally outside of Senator Michael Venditto's office to encourage him to support the GMO labeling bill that right now is up in Albany. New York really has a chance to join states like Vermont in demanding GMO labeling. This has been going on for a couple of years. I was at a rally outside his office last year as well. It was really nice to hear that actually the night before the rally yesterday, he actually signed on to support the bill. So he is supporting it. It is right now in the Rules and Ways grouping and has to get out of there before it can get past. So keep your eyes open for anything you can do to help move this GMO labeling bill through our Congress in Albany. It's really important that we have transparency in the foods we eat, again, so that we can make well-educated choices. You know, there's over, I think, 60 countries that have banned GMOs completely, and then the majority of the other countries have it mandatory labeling. It's really amazing that there's such a fight against it. The Grocery Manufacturers Association is pouring millions of dollars into trying to fight this bill, because there's a bill going on right now that I know you've heard of called the DARC Act in Congress in Washington that is trying to make, they're actually trying to pass this bill as a voluntary option for mandatory labeling. But what it really does is it makes it illegal for states to mandate labeling. So it's really not a good thing. You know, they're trying to promote it as being a good thing to give us the right to know, but it really does the opposite. So just stay aware of all of this. GMOs are just really scary. Last week, actually, the United States Department of Agriculture just approved two new strains of corn to be planted, two new strains of genetically modified corn that is stronger than the usual Roundup Ready corn. Now, this one has extra chemicals to fight the super weeds and the super bugs that have mutated since we've been using glyphosate, the Roundup Ready products as a, you know, right now. The weeds and the bugs have mutated to be resistant to the GMO corn, and so now they need to make the GMO corn stronger. So the way that this whole GMO green revolution was sold to the public, although we didn't really have much choice, was that it was going to create more product. We were going to have better yields. We were going to have less environmental destruction because they were going to have to use less pesticides and less herbicides, and none of that ended up being true. Just another one of those situations that was good for the companies that made billions of dollars, but not good for the people. And then who's left to clean it up? We've also been reading about the earthquakes and how many more earthquakes are happening in states like Oklahoma that didn't used to have earthquakes, and now they have earthquakes. Why? Because of the fracking. And then when they have the earthquakes that are a result of pumping millions of gallons of wastewater down into the earth rock, who's left to clean up from the damage of the earthquakes? Do those biotech companies have to pay for that? I don't think so. Not the biotech companies, I'm sorry, the oil and gas companies that have been doing the fracking. No, they don't pay for the mess. It's the tax people that pay for the mess. So, you know, and they were talking about that in the movie Vaxxed. I mean, everything's so connected, and you know, the whole big problem is just systemic. And as much as it's frustrating, especially for those of us that have been on this path for so long, we have to take some comfort in seeing that it is starting to catch on. More people are talking about GMOs. More people want transparency in their food. More people are looking to eat healthier. It is growing. And so, as discouraging as it can be sometimes when you've been working on this for so long, you just see that things just take a long time. The right to vote, look how long that took. I saw, you know, the suffrage movie that was out last month, and it was a great movie about the fight for, you know, women in England getting the right to vote and what women have gone through to get that right to vote is huge. And so when women don't get out there to vote, or anybody get out there to vote, I mean, voting is a right that we all have, but it's also a privilege. And there's lots of people in many countries that are not allowed to vote. And so we all need to take that up and do the right thing. And the whole election, I'm not even going to go there. That's a whole other story. Not my area of expertise, but it is another area to watch very closely. I do have some petitions that I want to raise your awareness to on my website, signing the petition for the Monsanto DARC Act to stop that bill from passing in Washington. Also to ask Panera Bread to remove GMOs from their products. And then also to ask Walmart to promote selling fruits and vegetables that might not be perfect. We're calling it the ugly produce. It's been really big in Europe, getting groceries to sell less than perfect produce, you know, at a discounted rate, but then it's not wasted. People who have trouble affording really beautiful produce can get this beautiful produce that it might not look cosmetically gorgeous, but it still tastes delicious. It's still grown well, and there's no reason for it to end up on a landfill when somebody can eat it who's hungry. So promoting the buying of less than perfect fruit and vegetables and saving some money and keeping it out of a landfill is a really great, great thing. So promoting food sellers like Walmart and Whole Foods to sign on is really big. Whole Foods now did sign on, and we're trying to ask Walmart to do the same. So check that out. Some things going on in and around the city. Tonight there's a great documentary film called The True Cost film, and that's being shown at the Cinema Arts Center. It was screened last week, and it was such a success that they brought it in last minute again at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And this is also going to be paired with an eco-fashion show and a panel discussion following the screening. And it's at 7 p.m. at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. It's about the clothing manufacturers and the impact that clothing has on our environment and our health and the people who make it. This weekend, April 8th and 9th, the Food and Enterprise Summit is happening. That's happening in Brooklyn. It's bringing together entrepreneurs and financiers and people who care about our local food system together to look at the social impact and ways that food investors can, invest with impact and help a startup company. So it's a really wonderful event. Also, April 10th through the 12th is the Chefs Collaborative Summit, and that's also bringing together lots of professional chefs for education, inspiration, and celebration. And that this year is taking place in New York City, so if you are local and you're interested, it's a great event. April 11th, SunWorks is having their 8th annual fundraiser. SunWorks is a great organization that brings environmental science and sustainability to public schools in New York City. April 13th is Just Eat It, a food waste story, and that's another documentary being shown at the Cinema Arts Center. What else? Food Rich Summit is a great thing that I just found out about. This is going to be bringing together people that are already food secure to talk about people that are not food secure and how we can end hunger in New York City. And this is going to take place at Fordham University on the Lincoln Center campus, April 14th from 9 to 3. There's a price range there. You can go onto the website to find out more about that. All of these things I do list on my website as well. There's a pop-up on Earth Day at Columbus Circle on the second floor mezzanine, and this is going to be April 14th. It's a pop-up store that is selling recycled clothing, and they're offering, anyone who drops anything off, they're offering $5 towards recycling rewards. But I thought that was fun and unusual for that neighborhood, and thought it could be an interesting thing. I have lots more, but I don't want to take the time to go over them all. Although I do want to mention the Wellness in the Schools Gala is coming up April 18th and Food Tank Summit April 20th and 21st. That's in Washington, D.C. But there's so many great things going up, you know, sheep shearing up at Stone Barns, a free garden workshop up at Stone Barns. So go onto my website at IE Green and check out the calendar of events. They're really great. So I want to share with you my recipe so that I can bring my guest on. This week, I made a vegetable linguine carbonara. I'm always playing with the carbonara theme because that's one of my husband's favorite dishes, spaghetti carbonara. And, of course, I'm not cooking meat anymore. Actually, I haven't really cooked meat ever since I've been cooking for me to consume. I do for clients. But anyway, I'm not cooking meat. So I make a vegetable linguine carbonara. I made a mushroom one a couple months ago that was really great. This one has mushrooms in it, but it was wonderful, and so I want to share it with you. I used a pound of whole wheat spaghetti. one large organic onion cut into slivers, 3 portobello mushrooms, 1 cup of carrots diced, 2 cups of broccoli florets, half a cup plus or minus extra virgin olive oil, 1/4 teaspoon red pepper flakes, 1 cup of grated Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, 2 tablespoons of minced garlic, 2 organic eggs, 2 teaspoons of tamari, 1/2 cup of fresh Italian parsley chopped, and salt and pepper to taste. And you also can use hot red pepper flakes if you want any spice added to it at the end. So you're going to cook the pasta according to directions, and you're going to have the boiling water sitting there and wait to put the pasta in until your vegetables are getting close to ready, so that the pasta is only going to take 8 to 10 minutes or so, and you want everything to be ready when the pasta is ready so that the timing works. So while you have that water getting ready, you're going to coat the bottom of a cast iron pan with some olive oil and saute the mushrooms first. And you want to saute them with 1 tablespoon of the garlic and cook them up until they start really getting crisp. They will dry out. They will absorb most of the water. And then at that point, you're going to add the tamari. And what the tamari is going to do is it's going to sear the mushrooms and make them a little crispy so that they resemble a little bit of that bacon that we're not putting into our carbonara. And then I removed the mushrooms from the pan and set them aside. And then I put a little bit more olive oil into the pan and added the onions. And the onions got to cook in the tamari that was left on the cast iron pan, and helped brown the onions really beautifully. Then I added the carrots and the remaining garlic and cooked that for another 5 minutes or so. Then I added the broccoli and I kept cooking. And I reduced the heat once the broccoli was cooked and just let it really saute there for a while so all the vegetables got soft and caramelized a bit. If you're going to use the red pepper flakes, you can add them at that point. Then I also returned the mushrooms back into the pan so that all the vegetables were together. I've now put the pasta into the boiling water, and it's just ready to come out. But first I wanted to beat the 2 eggs with the Parmesan cheese in a separate bowl so that you're making a little mixture with the cheese and the eggs. I drained the pasta, reserving 1/2 cup of the water so that I could add that in if I wanted a little bit more liquid into my dish, which I did. And then I added the pasta right into the cast iron pan and mixed that up really well and tossed it with all of the vegetables. And then I added the Parmesan cheese and egg mixture into the pan. And the egg cooks right onto the heat of the pasta. At this point, I've turned the pan off, and I'm just tossing the pasta with the egg and cheese mixture and all the vegetables, and just, you know, makes a beautiful sauce. If it's a little too dry for you, you can add 1 tablespoon at a time of the reserved pasta water. And then you add the parsley, toss that in, and serve it. And you can serve it with a little bit more grated cheese on the side and some parsley. And that's it. It's beautiful. It's very quick. It's a great midweek meal because you can pull it together so fast, and served it with a really big, beautiful green salad. And it was a great meal. So I hope you get to make it. And if you do, please give me a little hoot and let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jessica Ryder. She is the director of the Be In Fit program at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore. She has been at the Department of Pediatrics at Montefiore and Albert Einstein Hospital since 2001, and she's focused a lot of her work on polycystic ovarian syndrome in adolescent girls and also in obesity management with these young girls. And so I'm going to let her come on and tell us more about the program and the work that she's doing. Dr. Jessica Ryder, are you with us?
Yes, hi. Hi, Bhavani. Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks for joining us. It's wonderful to have you on, and it's wonderful to learn about the work you're doing.
Thank you.
So can you tell me first, you know, and for my listeners, just what inspired you? What was your initial passion in focusing on teen girls?
Well, I had originally started when I came to Montefiore back in 1995. I had been a resident at the time, and then I went into fellowship in adolescent medicine, and I was focusing on reproductive health in girls, because initially they had, you know, they were having irregular periods. So that was my initial area of interest, but it pretty quickly transitioned to my concern about their weight, because a lot of my patients, and it wasn't just girls, it was boys and girls, were I was already noticing back in the late 90s that they were starting to gain weight, and a lot of the kids, to me, seemed like they really didn't have a place to go to participate in any physical activity, and they were hanging out at home, and they seemed a little isolated, and so that was really what spurred me more than the reproductive health. But it was sort of, I was noticing the trends even before there was a lot of the literature out about the epidemic of obesity. I was just sort of seeing it in my patients, and I was thinking, you know, these kids, I was telling them, get off the train and stop earlier or dance in your living room, but they were saying that, you know, we don't have a place to go or do anything. Mm-hmm. So that's when I sort of said, you know, we got to do something about this, because I felt frustrated clinically that I was seeing the kids gaining weight, and, you know, I was giving them advice that seemed not that fun for these
right.
kids, you know, to just be sitting at home or getting off the train. And, you know, and it wasn't just the health effects. It was just also the socialization of getting out and meeting different kids. And you know, for many, many of our families, it's a real safety issue. So a lot of the parents wanted their kids to come home, just because they didn't want them out and about in the Bronx and you know, worry about their safety.
Right, right. That makes sense. Did you see a correlation between the polycystic ovarian syndrome that you were working with and weight? Like, were they connected?
Yes. Well, I did. I mean, it is known that girls with polycystic ovarian syndrome have, you know, are more prone to gaining weight. And I did a study back as part of my fellowship, and we did notice that the girls who, that the predictors of having high androgen levels, which is really sort of what is, you know, the characteristic that causes a lot of the menstrual problems, is the girls develop high androgen levels. And we noticed there was a strong association with that and waist circumference. So the higher the waist circumference, the higher the androgen levels. And so, yes, definitely with increased weight gain. And so you can actually see with girls or women who have, you know, an excess amount of weight, there are medications that you can use to help normalize your menstrual cycles. But if you lose 10% of your body weight, you can also normalize your menstrual cycles. So that was, you know, to me, and you had sort of referenced that, if we sort of address some of the underlying health issues, rather than giving medications, we might actually be able to solve some of our medical problems without a lot of drugs.
Mm-hmm. And with the chicken and the egg syndrome, do you have a sense of which comes first? Are the kids overweight and that's what's causing the ovarian cystic problem or the hormone imbalance? Or is it more the hormone imbalance is affecting their weight? Or are you not clear on that?
I mean, I think it can be both ways, but there definitely is a genetic predisposition to developing PCOS. So you could have a woman who has PCOS, who has normal cycles and has, you know, no issues with fertility or none of the medical complications of PCOS because she watches her weight and she exercises. But it tends to be a genetic predisposition, just like type 2 diabetes is a genetic predisposition that we will clinically, you know, we can moderate it by really watching what we eat and what we do with exercise. That goes for hypertension, cardiovascular disease, so all those things. You have genes that predispose you, but if you really work on living a healthy lifestyle, you can really alter the trajectory of that illness.
Right, absolutely. So you want to share with me and the listeners about the Being Fit program and who you serve and the structure of the program?
Sure. So we're in the midst of changing it right now, but what we have originally started with and what we've sort of been doing over the past 10 years is we started by developing a partnership with Moshula Montefiore Community Center, and my responsibility over here at the Children's Hospital is really to do the medical, the nutrition, and the mental health piece, and then we would have the kids go over to the community center where they would participate in group classes. They would get the classes at least twice a week, where they would have nutrition classes, and then they would have behavioral modification classes. We would talk about mindfulness, stress reduction, ways of coping with stress other than eating. So there was a lot of education of the kids, and then there was always a physical activity component at least twice a week, but they could often come more. And over the years, the structure has changed in terms of the availability of the physical activity, but that's really a lot of the work is done at the community center, and then the kids would come back to the clinic where we would monitor them for their blood pressure, the development of diabetes, any orthopedic issues, hypertension. You know, there's a myriad of medical problems that you can get with, you know, when your weight is higher than it needs to be or than it should be, and those are the things that we manage. And the nutritionist would go on site to the community center and do one-on-one sessions with the kids and their families, just to give them more, you know, intensive one-on-one treatment beyond the classes. And then we did once a month family nights, where we would have the kids and the parents involved in cooking a snack, and then we would also do a physical activity and some type of nutritional activity, and that was usually about an hour and a half, about once a month. And then at one point, we haven't done it recently, but at one point we had been doing a summer camp. So the kids would go to away as part of the community center. They have day camps, and so we would put our kids on a bus, and they would go, you know, usually within an hour to local campsites, and then they would just go out and experience camp. And that was new for a lot of our kids. And then the nutritionist would spend some time with the families talking about how to make a healthy lunch and what to buy. Like, you know, these are the five healthy lunch options that you could, you know, you could bring to camp, and then they would plan it in advance, and then they would take their lunch to camp. And so it was sort of a...
So it was a day camp, not a sleepover.
It was a day camp, yeah. And it was
Do it for 1 week?
It was up to, I mean, they offered it. We did it in two-week blocks, but they could do 2 weeks or 4 weeks. And I believe at one point we even had it for 6 weeks. And that was something that we joined them. And, you know, it changed over the years. Initially, the nutritionist and the social worker created the meals, and we ordered the food. And then we said, you know, we just don't have the budget for this. And so then we sort of had the families then go out and do it. And that's when that was a very interesting experience, because we had initially sort of felt that our families really need our help, you know, to make lunches. You know, they're struggling to make lunches. But it was very interesting when we spent the time with the families to sort of educate them how, you know, these are the things you can buy, and, you know, being very mindful of budget and, you know, the cost of lunch. It was really incredible how the kids always brought their lunch, and they were always participating, and they were really capable of doing it. And that's sort of when I started to really realize that, you know, it's very important to not underestimate your patients and your families, you know, to really understand that, you know, all of us want good health, and all of us want to do what we need to do, and we have to sort of support our families, but not, you know, not take away that, you know, desire for them to really take part of, you know, contributing to their own health by making their own lunches, you know. And that was a very interesting experience. And it was sort of the same thing with the family nights. We used to do all the family nights. The staff would prepare the food, or we would order the food, and then it got costly. And then I said, you know, this is crazy. We should just have the families contribute. And it made a difference, because I think then the kids and the parents had a lot more buy-in, and it was more their program and more their evening. It was a lot more fun that way as well.
Uh-huh. So they would bring their own food from home, and then you raw food that you would then cook together, or already prepared food?
Well, sometimes what we did, I mean, we had events, so sometimes we'd have a summer picnic, sometimes we'd have a holiday party, and then that's when we would have the families bring food from home, but the nutritionist would spend time with them discussing what they wanted to bring and how to make it healthy. And so they would get some coaching around what, you know, how to make some modifications and substitutions. And then for a lot of the programming, you know, during the groups when we would do a cooking class, so the nutritionist also on Fridays, she did cooking class, she would get the ingredients and then she would prepare a really simple recipe with the kids. Like they would do smoothies or they would do a salsa and then they would make it together.
Mm-hmm.
Just
right.
In the interest of time, you know, just in terms of having, because the kids often would come straight after school. So she would have the ingredients ready, and then the kids would make it together with her.
Right. Yeah, and I think a lot of times potlucks are a wonderful way of going because, like you said, it gets everybody involved. You know, I do that a lot of times when I have, you know, slow food meetings. And, you know, of course, you have people of like mind, and I would think in a program like yours, if you're going over what type of foods for people to bring so that everyone's not bringing chips,
yeah.
You know, it can work and really be nice.
Well, you also learn, the food was amazing. I mean, when we had our potlucks, it was incredible food. People would bring all sorts of different kinds of foods from, you know, different parts of the world. And so we got to share, different ideas. One thing we had done a few years back is we created a cookbook. And it was really, again, you know, family traditional recipes that families loved or that the kids loved. And again, they spoke to the nutritionist, and she modified them to make sure they were healthy. So we created a Be In Fit cookbook, and that was something
that was
really fun. And I would like to do more of that in the future in terms of it just really gets the kids excited about it.
Sure.
You know.
Sure. So how have the outcomes been from this program? What kind of results are you seeing, and how are you impacting the community?
So what we have found, we did a study back in about 2010, and we published it back in 2013, and it was really a pre and post evaluation of the 9-month program, and we looked at about 349 kids. The average age of the kids is about 15. About 50, just over half were girls and just under half were boys. And the mean weight of the kids was about 242 pounds with a mean BMI of about 39. And about almost just over two-thirds of the kids really met criteria for severe obesity. So we were sort of dealing with kids. Our recruitment is really 12 to 21, but the average age is about 15. In order to get into the program, you have to have a BMI in excess of the 95th percentile for age and sex. So we really wanted to focus on only those kids who really were struggling and really needed more help. So half of the kids in the Bronx are overweight or obese, and about 20% are obese. So we were really targeting that upper 20%. And of those kids that came to us, two-thirds met criteria for severe obesity. So their BMI is, you know, even greater than the 99th percentile for sex and age.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of our kids had a lot of comorbidities, so a lot of them had asthma, blood pressure, type 2 diabetes. More than half the kids had parents who struggled from obesity and weight issues that they were concerned about. And almost 70% of the kids really didn't even want to come to the program. So their parents
right.
brought them. And so we had really low motivation to make changes. And it's not just that they don't feel like it. I think for a lot of our kids in the Bronx here, there's, many, many other things that are kind of taking priority for them. And so it's just low on their priority list of things that they need to deal with. About half of our kids ate about zero fruits or vegetables per day, and more than a third watched 6 or more hours of TV or played computer games. So we had pretty low healthy behaviors, exhibited at baseline.
How much TV? 6 hours a day?
More than 6 hours, 6 or more, yeah. And it's getting harder and harder to quantify because nowadays kids are on their handheld devices and it's linked with homework, and I've really struggled to quantify that because kids are on the phones and so are adults all the time. So what's work related,
right,
doing homework, phoning, texting, I mean there's all sorts of different things that kids do on the phones, and it's really hard to quantify the amount of time that they're spending.
Right, but while they're doing it, they're not exercising or playing or doing
that's
something
right.
that's, you know, active.
That's right. I have a drill over my head. I don't know if you can hear that. I hope it's not too loud.
No, a little, not too bad.
And about three-quarters of the kids drank one or more sugary drinks a day, and that's soda juice, any kind of sugared beverage. And I had said about, you know, more than half consumed no fruits or vegetables at all. And then about less than 20% spent time doing vigorous physical activity on a daily basis. But almost 90% spent two or more hours watching TV. So the kids spent a lot of time watching TV. And then what we looked at, we compared the rate of change in their weight from the year prior to enrolling in the program to the year after enrolling in the program. And the main reason for that is because what I noticed is that some of the kids would gain up to 50 pounds in the year prior to coming to the program. And for a lot of these kids, because they're still growing, for me, a reasonable outcome is to actually have weight maintenance.
Right, right.
As an initial target. Because if they're growing, I mean, some boys will grow up to six inches in a year if they're really going through a major growth spurt. And if they can maintain their weight, you know, there's a lot of thinning out happening there.
Right, right.
And so what we found is there was a decrease in the rate of weight gain. Once they came to the program. And then we found also that for each nutrition and physical activity session that they came, there was a significant drop in their BMI. And that we also noticed that at the end of participating in the program, there was an increase in the number of fruits and vegetables that were consumed and also significant improvements in their physical activity. But we did not show an improvement in their use of TVs, computers, or video games. And I think part of that is just as a society, over that interval, it's just becoming more and more and more, and it's harder to quantify. So we really did not have success with that, although we were able to get them more physically active. And then the disappointing thing that we also found when we checked weights a year after they had completed the program is that there was a rebound weight gain. So mm-hmm. when kids come to the program, they were able to lose or maintain their weight, but when they left the program, they would gain the weight. And that's, you know, when I have attended the Obesity Society meetings in the past, there's a lot of literature in adults that shows that, you know, if you come to programs or if you go to Weight Watchers and you have that reinforcement and that support, people will tend to do better. When they don't come, you know, when life gets overwhelming or there's too many other things going on or you're just not really ready to make those changes, the weight comes back. But once people come back to care or come back to whatever it is that they're doing that helps them to lose the weight, they tend to do better. So there's this up and down that happens, and we see that even with the kids. But we found that the more frequently we saw them, the more often they came. It's just families and kids really benefit from checking in and having that support and that accountability of how things are going and, you know, how can we problem solve to overcome some of these issues that are making it difficult for you to lead a healthy lifestyle.
Sure. I know you mentioned that you made some changes, and I want to hear about those, but let's take a couple-minute break first, and when we come back, maybe we can talk about what you did to try to, you know, change that up a little bit.
Sure.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Dr. Jessica Ryder. Be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm here with Dr. Jessica Ryder talking about the Being Fit program that she runs at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore. Jessica, are you with me?
Yeah.
Great.
I am.
So after you did this study and you know, saw the outcomes that you saw, Were there any changes you made after that to try to change it up a little bit?
Yeah, so we, I mean, one of the other things that I hadn't mentioned is that we struggled to retain these kids. We would enroll the kids, new kids, weekly. So we had two new kids coming through our clinic each week, and we had a hard time having the kids retained. So, you know, for the duration of the 9-month program, so we would lose kids after the 3 months, and we only had about a 26% retention. On average, it would vary from 26 to 50%, you know, in different years. And so, you know, they initially came from all over to the hospital, and then from there they would get engaged in the program, and then we would bring them over to the community center. So it would be a different site. And we, you know, we sort of wanted to connect with the community center philosophy of, you know, how can we retain these kids, because that's what the community center is really good at, engaging kids and engaging families and having, you know, longevity. So they really have kids from, you know, birth till, you know, 100 years, and families grow up in the community center. And you know, from what we saw, where, you know, if we lose these kids, they're going to gain their weight back. I want to sort of work on creating an environment that it's, you know, that there's a progression that, you know, each year we tend to give these kids more responsibility. So if, you know, as an example, at a community center, kids will go to camp, and then there'll be a camp counselor, then there'll be a youth leader, you know, so there's opportunities for growth and development within the community center experience. And so what we wanted to try to do was to sort of bring it on site, the whole program on site, including the medical, the nutritional, and the mental health piece, as well as the after-school programming piece, and sort of infuse it into the existing infrastructures of these institutions. So when we had originally done the after-school program, it was part of the after-school structure, but they really run from 3:30 to 5:30 every single day, and we would only go from, you know, 4:30 to 6:30 twice a week. So we were not quite aligned with what they were doing, because we were trying to offer something more unique for our kids who were a little more overweight. We wanted to do something a little more intensive. And what I'm trying to do now is to sort of focus a little more on making it a more of a wellness experience for a broader range of kids, mainly because I want to reduce the stigma. I don't want it to be a weight management program. I want it to be a wellness program. And so I'd want to make it open to everyone. One of my concerns with offering it, you know, to a general population of kids in the school is that sometimes what happens is when you offer a service, the kids who, you know, are interested will come, but the kids who need it the most tend to get pushed off to the side, maybe because they're shy or maybe because they don't have the negotiating ability to get themselves into the program. And so we want to be able to identify the kids who would benefit from the program, make the program open to everyone, but also put in, you know, a system so that we won't be losing those kids who would most benefit from the program. So we're trying to walk the fine line of offering a general wellness program for everybody so that it's part of the after-school experience, and fitting it into the after-school setup, but not, you know, forgetting the kids who need it the most, which is why I started the program in the first place. We will do our medical piece in the school during the school day as part of our Montefiore School Health Program. They already have clinics there. We will have a nutritionist. We're working on getting nutrition support to be able to see the kids individually during the school day. And, you know, they take them out for lunch or for breaks. And then they would have their medical visits, you know, every couple of months where we check in on their target weights and their target goals. And then they would just right from there go to the after-school program. The other change we've made is we've tried to simplify our message and to really reduce the concepts to, you know, there's some 7 basic things that we need that will help us be healthy. So we talk about not skipping meals, eating breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks. It's a big issue in my community where a lot of the adolescents skip breakfast, and they often skip their school lunch or don't have lunch. we really enforce lots of vegetables, so at least 3 to 6 servings of vegetables a day, 2 to 3 servings of fruit. We talk about increasing our sugar-free beverage consumption, or basically drinking more water and less of the sugary drinks. Having at least 2 hours less than 2 hours of screen time a day. Increasing physical activity, so at least an hour of vigorous physical activity where you're sweating and getting flushed and really working out a day. And then the other thing that we've added that a lot of the literature doesn't really talk about when they talk about healthy lifestyles and nutrition and physical activity and weight is a lot of people don't talk about sleep. But I've really noticed that the sleep hygiene of a lot of my kids it's not surprising that they're gaining weight because there's so much sleep deprivation. So a lot of the kids, you know, are going to bed very late. They're waking up in the middle of the night. They're on their phones in the middle of the night. There's a lot of kids with sleep apnea, so they're snoring and they're not getting a good rest, so they're tired during the day. So I've really added that as a dimension that if you don't get your 9 hours of sleep, we're going to have a hard time, you know, becoming healthy and coming, you know, to a healthy weight and growing and developing properly. So that's something, you know, those sort of simplifying that message and sort of reinforcing each of those target behaviors throughout our curriculum when we see them in the individual, you know, visits with the clinicians. And in our after-school experience, that's how we're sort of trying to change the program. And we're planning on doing a trial of this in the fall. So we're sort of ramping up and getting that all prepared. So we're screening kids, and then we'll do an orientation for the kids and their families at the school, and then do our medical clearance and evaluations over the summer, and then start as part of the existing after-school infrastructure to get them into the program in the fall.
Uh-huh. And how many kids can you accommodate?
Well, we probably would start with a pilot anywhere from 30 to 60 in the after school in the current school that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just as a pilot, just to see. I mean, and they have 200 kids in their after school program. So a portion of those kids, you know, all those kids in the after school program already have leadership classes. They have STEM. They have literacy. And then they have a bunch of different, you know, arts and crafts. They can do yoga. They can do dodgeball. They can play flag football. So we will still have the leadership classes, but our leadership classes will really consist of talking a lot about we'll infuse our curriculum into that leadership class, and then we'll add in a cooking class as part of the leadership class, and then, you know, there's 3 leadership classes a week, and then we'll add in you know, a mandatory physical activity, more skill-based session, and then the kids can participate with other kids in the after-school and all the other physical activities. So they have freedom, so they're still integrated with the after-school, but their leadership will be a little more unique for wellness for that particular cohort of kids that will come through.
Uh-huh. That sounds really exciting. You know, if you can incorporate it and really get, like you said, the buy-in, you know, on a larger scale.
Yeah, and I think it will take time. You know, it takes time to change the culture, time to get the, you know, and it's not just, you know, always talk about the families needing to change, but it's our institutions and infrastructures that need to accommodate, you know, sort of the needs of these kids, and then also really looking at our strengths. I mean, there's a lot of strengths in the after school. There's a lot of strengths in the clinical realm. There's a lot of strengths in the school. Instead of all reinventing the wheel, why don't we just harness what we all have and sort of somehow try to synchronize that so we're you know, we're not duplicating efforts, but we're supporting each other. And that's one of the big things I've learned over the years is that takes some time. And you got to kind of look around a little to see what you already have,
right?
You know,
right.
Work together.
Can you share with us what is the Lunch for Learning campaign that you're working with?
So the Lunch for Learning campaign has been something that's been really advocacy for universal lunch in the schools, and that is something that. I have not initiated the campaign, or I'm not 100% familiar with all of the aspects of it, but it's really initiated by the Community Food Advocates organization, and they're really trying to address this issue where if we don't have meal frequency, breakfast and lunch, kids are not going to learn as well, they're not going to be as healthy, and I see it every day in my clinic where, you know, I have kids who skip breakfast, skip lunch, and then they have a lot of the caloric intake is happening later on in the day when they're not as active.
Right.
And so they're not getting the calories during the day when they're both mentally and physically active, and it shows. So, you know, there's issues with behavioral, there's issues with, you know, management of your emotions in class, there's, you know, issues with academic functioning. And so those are real issues that we're seeing when kids are not having a healthy lunch or a lunch at all. And so the universal free lunch really is, you know, is proposing that we have lunch for everyone so that, you know, there's no stigma associated with having a free lunch because you're too poor to get, you know, to pay for lunch on your own. So it sort of is really trying to address the stigma associated with free school lunch, you know, based on income. And I'm a strong advocate of it because I think, you know, the first thing we need to do is to get the kids lunch. And I know, you know, there's a lot of people who are concerned about the quality of school lunch and about, you know, whether it's appealing to kids. I think we have to start first by getting the school lunch, you know, universal so that there's availability. And then I think the next step is where we work together, again, harnessing the strengths of all the people who are interested in advocating for meal frequency for kids and healthy lunches for kids, that we work together to make those lunches something that the kids, you know, are excited about, and changing that lunchroom culture instead of being a negative experience or something the kids want to avoid, how do we sort of make it a positive experience? And I think that, you know, what I've learned from the, you know, my work with the community and even in the schools is, you know, the teachers and the community staff are just really good at engaging kids and getting kids excited about doing projects or doing things, and I think we just have to harness that and apply that, you know, to our lunchroom experience for the kids as well.
Mm-hmm.
So right now it's kind of a negative experience for many kids.
The lunchroom, absolutely.
Yeah.
They wait online for so long. By the time they get it, they have no time to eat it, and yeah, it's really bad. And also the quality is, you know, despicable. You know, I know Michelle Obama worked really hard this year to try to improve, not just this year, over her tenure in the White House, working to improve school lunches and, you know, the organic garden on the front lawn and raise awareness. And she really was doing a good job, but there was so much pushback from the big food corporations. I mean, the frozen pizza lobbying and the frozen French fry lobbying. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that they have such power, but they do. And someone told me, you know, one of the things Ted Cruz said, you know, if he gets elected, the first thing he's going to do is bring French fries back to the school lunches. I'm like, really?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I really believe in terms of the advocacy, you know, what we as medical providers, you know, our job is to find problems. And, you know, we have been trained to provide prescriptions and give medical plans that involve medications and say, you know, you need this, you need us, you can't do this without these drugs. And I think that there are many drugs that are critical and are life-saving and very necessary. But I think medications are part of an entire picture. Good health, you know, we want to have the fundamentals. You know, it's in the same way I would tell a kid or my own kids, you know, it's important for us to have fun and to play and do all these great other things, but not until we get the basics down. You know, let's eat properly, let's sleep properly, let's get our homework done, you know, and then maybe we can watch some TV, or then maybe we can go out and play and do all these other things. So I think we have to sort of, you know, tell our families and make them feel, you know, that they have the strength and the ability to make these changes that are very fundamental and very basic. And I know my families want to be healthy, and I know they want to believe that they can they can do these things. And I think sometimes some of our families, when I first meet them, they don't have hope. They don't think they can make these changes. And then when you spend the time with people and you work with them and you connect with them and you make a relationship with them and you say, you know, we're in this together, we're going to get through, you know, it may not happen in 2 weeks. It may take a year or 2 years. But once you build that partnership with the families and the kids, you know, as you know,
can see the change can happen.
Yeah, from a pediatrician's perspective, I mean, kids
can
grow up.
So, Jessica, really, really fast, because we're just about out of time, can you share your website with everybody so anyone listening can click on?
The website. So you mean in terms of
being fit?
Yeah, it's at cham.org.
CHAM, standing for the Children's Hospital at Montefiore, right?
/BeInFit.
Great. And everyone, it will be on my website, too. I want to thank you all for joining us. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And everyone listening.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of the day.